Possible in part by a grant from Champaign-Danville Overhead Doors, serving businesses and families since 1959 in Ogden, Illinois.
This is the Afternoon Magazine on WILL AM 580. I'm Celeste Quinn. Good afternoon. Thanks for joining us today. As this year marks the 50th anniversary of the landmark Supreme Court decision, Brown v. Board of Education, we've seen and heard many stories about the celebrated case. Much of the reporting and reflection has focused on the promise of the decision handed down in 1954. On the program today, we take a look at Brown with legal scholar Derek Bell. His latest book is Silent Covenants, Brown v. Board of Education and the Unfulfilled Hopes for Racial Reform. Bell says while Brown recognized racial injustice, it left racial barriers intact. He likens the decision to, quote, a magnificent mirage, the legal equivalent of that city on a hill to which all aspire without any serious thought that it will ever be attained. Listeners, I invite you to join the discussion with your questions and comments. I look forward to hearing from you. You can join us with a telephone call. The number in the Champaign-Urbana area is 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, call toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Derek Bell is a visiting law professor at New York University Law School. He was for 15 years a member of the faculty of the Harvard Law School. During the 1960s, he was a legal defense fund lawyer for the NAACP and supervised hundreds of school desegregation cases. He is the author of many books, including Race, Racism, and American Law, Ethical Ambition, Living a Life of Meaning and Worth, and Faces at the Bottom of the Well. Derek Bell's latest book, Silent Covenants, Brown v. Board of Education and the Unfulfilled Hopes for Racial Reform, is published by Oxford University Press. Again, the phone number is 333-9455, 800-222-9455. Professor Bell, good afternoon. Thanks so much for joining us today.
Good afternoon, Celeste. Nice to, I appreciate the invitation.
Oh, well, my pleasure to talk with you. When the court handed down Brown, you were on a ship headed home from Korea.
Right.
Two questions to begin. What were your first thoughts and hopes for Brown, and how did your thinking about the decision change over time?
You know, I think that most black people and white progressives thought it was the beginning of a new era. That and in some ways it was, but not the new era we'd hoped for. I think that Thurgood Marshall said, well, schools will all be desegregated in within 5 years. I guess it was that the court had now said in law what black people had experienced, in fact, for so long, the degradation, the humiliation, the disadvantage, the second-class citizenship, if you will, of official segregation sanctioned by law. And now that the court had said that was unconstitutional, we felt that if blacks were willing to, so to speak, let bygones be bygones about all that we had suffered, that surely whites who had been the beneficiaries of segregation, both physically and spiritually and what have you, that they too would, albeit reluctantly, agree to follow the law. And we were wrong, that the decision prompted a massive resistance sparked by politicians throughout the South. The manifesto issued by and signed by most of the Southern members of Congress, all of the necessity of sending troops to Little Rock and other places that had the audacity to actually try to desegregate their schools in compliance with the law. And in some ways, you know, people keep saying, well, Brown failed. But really, it was not Brown that failed. Brown spoke clearly about what the law should be. there was self-interest in terms of the country's needs in fighting communism to get rid of official segregation. And yet, much of the country in the South, and then as school desegregation spread to other parts of the country, school boards refused to comply. They used all manner of avoidance and evasion. And finally, when we finally got really strong court orders, white people moved, you know, to private schools, to far-off suburbs, so that we would be shipping blacks from a formerly all-black school, to the extent that they weren't closed as a part of the desegregation process, into schools that quite soon became all-black, that quite soon stopped getting the funding that they had gotten before, the attention that they had gotten before. We certainly didn't expect that was going to be the case in the 1954.
You note early in the book that some social scientists may see Brown as the perfect precedent, and you say they have a point, but you say that perfect precedent comes wrapped within a silent covenant, and here we get the title of your book,
yeah.
Silent Covenants. What is perfection in law in the area of social reform, and what do you mean by a silent covenant?
That often, particularly in the areas of social reform, the court may speak strongly against a injustice that's gone on for a long time. Striking down the death penalty was one. The decision in Roe v. Wade was probably another. And all those who had pushed for, in Brown v. Board, of course, all those who had pushed for those decisions hailed that decision. But if you read closely, you see that the statement is not written in invisible ink, but written in erasable ink. That is, if the opposition to this forward thrust, to this correction of injustice, is sufficiently strong, then the court and the country pulls back. The court may feel it has no alternative, as it felt it didn't with the death penalty, as over the years with regard to Roe v. Wade, and of course with Brown v. Board. What I see in the racial area is, in terms of a secret covenant, is that virtually every racial reform has come about not simply because of injustice that blacks are suffering or the proof of that injustice that their lawyers or their petitioners are able to show, but rather when policymakers, usually white policymakers at the top, see something in their interest or in the country's interest that causes them to respond positively, at least symbolically, to the claims for racial justice. That was the case with the Emancipation Proclamation, which is probably the first Civil Rights Act. Lincoln was basically trying to save the Union. And when he was convinced that issuing this Emancipation Proclamation, although it had no real legal meaning, that it would serve to further his effort to save the Union, that's when he issued it. You see, the same thing with Brown v. Board, which is the 20th century equivalent of the Emancipation Proclamation. The great push for why the court found school segregation unconstitutional in 1954 and not during any of the cases that were filed before it, dozens of them during the 19th century, is that in 1954 we were locked in the early phases of the Cold War with Russia, and communist nations were having a field day in their media talking about the segregation in this country, the lynching, and all the rest. And they were speaking to emerging third world countries coming out of colonial governments. Most of them were not white. So our State Department made many appeals, particularly in the briefs of the Supreme Court, about how important it was for our foreign policy to strike down segregation. And while not mentioned in the decision itself, it just seems to me that that was a major influence of why the court decided to issue the Brown decision in 1954.
Mm. Maybe you would cite some of the evidence for Brown as an anti-communist decision.
Yeah, you know, It's, as I say, all you have to do is, or your listeners, go to the library and get the amicus briefs that the government filed in the Brown cases, because, you know, there were two arguments and any number of briefs. And also in the cases leading up to Brown, those seeking desegregation at the graduate level, there were three or four or five of those cases. In each one, the government filed amicus briefs arguing strongly about the importance of to our foreign policy. Not only our foreign policy, Celeste, but also, remember, that was the McCarthy era. We were very concerned about subversion at home, and that this decision would send a message to those who were disgusted with the American system, or there was fear that they might be, that, hey, this was a new day, that the United States could really correct through law basic injustices. So that there is a book by a professor at Stanford, Mary Duziak, D-U-D-Z-I-A-K, and it's called Cold War Civil Rights. I cite it in my book, but it's about 300 pages in which she has gone through all manner of documents and letters and news clippings and all that show the strong relationship between the Brown decision and the improvement, at least for a while, of our foreign and domestic policies.
Hmm. Back to the idea of the silent covenant. Do you think the court made its own fallback move in the Brown 2 decision in 1955?
Well, you know, there were two decisions. 1954 was very strong, very forthright about the damage done by segregation and the need to recognize that by striking down the earlier separate but equal precedent. By 1955, the opposition had been so organized and fervent and threatening violence and everything else, and meanwhile, the Congress had done nothing. The president, President Eisenhower, had done nothing. He indicated his opposition to the decision. And so I sometimes think that the court really felt it had no alternative than to turn down the petitions of the black lawyers who were urging desegregation should happen immediately, and rather send the cases back to the lower courts that were, for the most part, not very friendly, and tell them that they could consider all manner of administrative problems, and finally they should desegregate with all deliberate speed.
Mm-hmm.
Well, many of those Southerners felt that meant never. You know, and in fact, there were no strong orders of desegregation for 10 to 12 years.
Hmm. What do we know about the deliberations that went on within the court for Brown 2?
You know, not very much. You know, we're not supposed to know anything, of course, but there are the memos and things that get out. There was more known about before the first decision. It was clear that some of the justices, particularly those from the South, were very concerned about resistance, about ignoring the decision or just flaunting the decision. And the court was very concerned, since the court does not have its own army to enforce its, it depends on its mm-hmm. prestige as the highest court in the land. And there was great concern, and I think that many people attribute the new Chief Justice, Earl Warren, really a great politician, with convincing the members of the court that they both should vote for it, and also that it should be a unanimous decision.
Hmm.
But by 55, he wrote the second, kind of fallback position, decision that was also unanimous, but it also really, rather than quiet the opponents, it simply encouraged them.
Hmm. What do you think, this is sort of a side issue, but what do you think about the court recently has opened itself up a little bit more to us in terms of allowing some sessions to be recorded and broadcast,
And, you know, I think it's in keeping with the kind of the modern trend of a judicial openness. I guess we have to thank or condemn court TV and some of the pseudo court shows with I don't watch them, so I don't remember. Don't know the names. Is it Judge Judy?
Judge Judy.
Some of those
yeah.
people that have brought in a really kind of dramatic, although rather false way, more of the court proceedings. And there are always pressures. You know, some courts allow proceedings to be televised. The Supreme Court has not allowed that, but they have been issuing more, you know, on a regular basis, the audio recordings of the arguments. Now, they have not allowed openness into the conference room,
mm-hmm.
and that probably is not going to happen.
Probably shouldn't happen.
And I guess probably shouldn't happen, but the, I don't know, I guess I don't feel as strongly about it as some. I had a student who just graduated who wrote a very long paper arguing that the jury in trial cases, that the jury room should be televised, that all the proceedings should be televised. And your immediate reaction is, oh, my God, no. But if you think about it, there would be clear disadvantages, but there also might be some advantages, too, based on what actually happens in some of those jury rooms in terms of the personalities involved and how that affects how people vote and what have you, then maybe some of that would be dampened down a little bit and people would be a little bit more serious if they knew that the you know the proceedings were going to be televised.
Mm. On the record. Yeah.
Yes, that's right.
Yeah. Legal scholar Derek Bell is our guest this afternoon. His latest book is Silent Covenants, Brown v. Board of Education and the Unfulfilled Hopes for Racial Reform. My name is Celeste Quinn. Listeners, this is the Afternoon Magazine, and you can join us with questions, comments. Here are the phone numbers in the Champaign-Urbana area, 333-9455. That's 333-WILL. Anywhere else, toll-free, 800-222-9455, 800-222-WILL. Let's talk with a listener on line one in Champaign. Good afternoon.
Hello, Professor Bell.
Yes.
I'm a native of Arkansas. Grew up 100 miles south of Little Rock, where the Little Rock Central fiasco took place in 1957. I graduated from high school in 1966, all black, and Brown versus Board had not been felt in my community.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, there were many, I remember many bumper stickers, impeach Earl Warren.
Oh, yes.
And the Supreme Court were prominently displayed by many Caucasian Americans in my community. But my question, I just wanted to give you a background. My question to you, and I heard Attorney Theodore Shaw, of the maybe the incoming or maybe now the,
he has the
president
new
director, and director of the Legal Defense Fund of the NAACP, comment similarly to you in this vein that they were, or Justice Marshall and I guess you and the other pioneers were nonplussed about the massive resistance to Brown. And my question, whenever I hear that said by distinguished scholars like you and attorneys like Attorney Shaw, is in light of how racism was so steeped in the culture of America, and especially in the South where many white males viewed integrated schools is simply an entree for African-American men to co-mingle with white females. Why were you surprised that mass resistance would ensue when Brown was issued?
You know, that's a very good question. I think what I'm saying now is really Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday morning quarterback. All I can say is that there is this sense, maybe it's a concomitant of being victims, that you're always hopeful that your oppressor is going to see the light. And since the Supreme Court is the Supreme Court, since it had upheld segregation for so many years, we thought that the Brown decision, it was going to see the light, and somehow whites were going to respond. Judge Robert L. Carter, who, of course, was one of the key lawyers back then often says in his speeches. He's 87 now, and he said that the lawyers thought that the evil was segregation. And as you may remember, segregation with the signs over the doors, it really was a burdensome thing. And that you felt if you got those signs down, if you got rid of the official segregation of schools and other facilities, that then everything would be okay. But he recognized later that the real evil, he said segregation was a manifestation of the evil. The real evil, as he puts it, is white supremacy, or racism. The deep sense in so many whites that while they may not have very much themselves, that they look like the people at the top and that they feel superior to blacks, whether those blacks are ahead of them, behind them, or what have you. And it manifests, and of course the politicians take full advantage of that, even up to the present day, but they certainly took advantage of it back in the 50s.
Mm-hmm.
I saw a film that you made, I'm not sure who did it, about Hoxie, H-O-X-I-E, Hoxie, Arkansas.
Yes, I know about Hoxie.
Because the school board there, these six white guys and the superintendent, felt that they should follow the law. They'd expected decision. They'd sent people, some of the teachers out in the community, and when a decision came down, they met and decided they would desegregate that fall.
Notwithstanding resistance to
that.
That.
Well, first there wasn't that much resistance.
But then the agitators.
That's right.
Like
that's
Jim Johnson, who was a card-carrying racist out of Crossett,
right.
Arkansas, came.
And they then had a year of very great difficulty.
Right.
But it showed that the politicians they didn't want this thing to work.
That's right.
You see, and but it's an interesting film. It's an encouraging film to see what people of courage, who are willing to do the right thing in the face of opposition, what they can accomplish, because they never back down.
They never did. That film was shown here locally on WILL TV.
Uh huh. So,
and I had the good fortune of seeing it, and it brought to light a form of black history in Arkansas that I had not quite fully appreciated. And there were other two instances where, without the notoriety of Hoxie, that is, areas with very small African-American communities, relatively speaking, Charleston, Arkansas, where Senator Del Bempas was on the school board, and Fayetteville, Arkansas, which is the home of the University of Arkansas flagship campus, they also integrated close to the 1954 date. And they didn't experience the riotous behavior of Hoxie because they basically kept it close to the vest, and the agitators did not quite know about it.
Yeah.
And they were very much geographically far removed from the mainstream of Arkansas.
Well, you know, Celeste, I don't want to take up too much time because I know you have other callers, but I just wanted to say to this gentleman that it's because of this pattern of politician organized violence and resistance that I sometimes think in terms of schools, not facilities, which I think would have been desegregated anyhow, but in terms of schools, and I argue this in my book, that we might have been better off education-wise had the court said, you know, black schools are in bad shape and what have you, but I think rather than striking down separate but equal, we should order enforcement, full enforcement of the equal part.
You know, and I tend to agree with you.
You know, because
the separate but equal, Professor Lonnie Grenier spoke here at the commencement ceremonies a couple of weeks ago, and she said Brown v. Board was a failure. And I've seen other black scholars, most notably Dean Alex Johnson now of Minnesota, write that the burden of integration has been borne most heavily by blacks.
Well, that's certainly true.
And what do we have to show for it?
Because, yeah, you know, most of our schools, particularly in the urban areas,
Christian academies,
are still very segregated and unequal.
Yes, thank you, sir.
Thank you.
Thank you for the call this afternoon. Other calls are invited. Questions, comments, 333-9455, the number in the Champaign-Urbana area. Anywhere else, toll-free 800-222-9455. Our guest this afternoon, legal scholar Derek Bell. The caller raised lots of good points, and I've got a couple of follow-up kinds of points I would like to raise with you.
Sure.
You have proposed an alternative decision to the court's decision in Brown. Let's talk about that further. you would have not over, you would not today, I think we should say, you would not today overturn Plessy, but in the in terms of school facilities, you would order its strict enforcement. Talk with us about that alternative vision.
Well, you know, first we thought that, and that's what the lawyers argue, we thought that segregation was the evil, and if you got the court to overturn the legal basis for it, it would disappear. But as Judge Carter said, it was a manifestation of the problem of racism or white superiority. And when you knocked out the separate but equal, it simply manifested itself in different forms. But on the other hand, had we recognized that while black schools, had we recognized the likely outcome, which we, as the gentleman indicated, we should have in terms of the violent response, but if we'd also recognized that black schools were unequal, sometimes horribly unequal, but even so, many black kids got good educations because the teachers were dedicated, the teachers knew the parents knew the teachers, they worked with what they had. They surely got the books after the white kids finished with them, but they worked with those books and used mimeograph things to upgrade them and, you know, update them and what have you. And if the court had ordered equalization, I think it would have been difficult for the segregationists to mount the major campaign that they did. You couldn't, if there was no talk of desegregation, but rather equalization, because equalization, Celeste, had been going on in many states. I don't know about Arkansas, but many of the southern states, albeit for the means of avoiding desegregation. So if the court had taken that and said, what you've been doing, in quotes, voluntarily, here we by order you to do it as a matter of this court order, if they had insisted that blacks from the black community be placed on the school boards as a part of this equalization, if they had set up monitoring teams of black, white individuals who would have to report to the court every month about how this equalization was going, it seems to me that you would have had more places like the Fayetteville and the other place in Arkansas and the Hoxies that desegregated voluntarily, simply because there weren't that many black kids there, and even some of the areas where there were more blacks, those county systems, for the most part, were not rich systems. And if they had had to provide the same facility for blacks and whites, more of them, it seems to me, on their own rather than through court order, would have moved toward voluntary desegregation.
I wonder, though, what if that had been a court's decision in 1954? Would there have been other calls for the impeachment of Earl Warren?
Well, I know the civil rights lawyers would not have been happy. But often, you know, it's sometimes with court cases, you organize better with a defeat than you do with a victory. You see, and we certainly have seen that from the other side with Roe v. Wade and the death penalty and certain these other progressive decisions that the opponents have really used the defeat as an organizing tool. But there were a number of things happening, Celeste, in the early 50s after World War II. Truman had already started taking steps to desegregate the armed services. Black soldiers were coming back from guaranteeing freedom and sparking movements. The Montgomery bus boycott really got started in organizations before the Brown decision. So that there were a lot of movements. Business had recognized, it seems to me, that segregation had been something that they had to do, but it wasn't good for business. I mean, in terms of hotels and restaurants, black people spend probably far too much money in some of those facilities. So that there were going to be a number of pressures that would have broken down segregation in public facilities. But schools were a special deal, and I just think that I didn't think it then. I got to reiterate, but I think now that knowing how
deeply set racism was and how strongly it manifested itself with regard to schools and allowing those arguments of black boys sitting down with white girls and what have you, going about it another way from a standpoint of education might have been a better way.
Mm. As I mentioned in my introduction, you worked on many school desegregation cases in the 60s, and you write about that in Silent Covenants. You have a chapter on that.
No, I probably, Thurgood Marshall hired me in 1960, just about the time that the sit-in started, and we were only five lawyers on the staff. And the school cases that had been filed had been kind of lying about, not much happening, and so as what Thurgood used to call me, the low man on the totem pole, I kind of got those cases. And then as more cases were filed and what have you, so by the time I left, I think I was supervising about 300 school desegregation cases, seeking racial balance and busing and all the rest, which I thought were the only way you could get around the school board's evasions and avoidances and the various plans that they would put forth that looked like desegregation, but really nothing really happened. Mm. So that I really believed that I was doing the right thing. And it's only years later, after I got into teaching, was able to look back and think and write about the what we'd actually gone through, that the goals that we were setting in terms of having each school reflect the racial balance of the blacks and the whites and the overall community seemed not as good an idea as it did at an earlier time.
Yeah. The children, the families who fought for desegregation, who the NAACP represented, what in the end was their experience? How do they feel about the fight they waged?
Well, as we see from the stories now, many of them had very horrible experiences.
Yeah.
Some of the famous Little Rock Nine are still kind of traumatized, and that got a lot more attention than desegregated schools in other places. Sometimes the black children were met with welcome, particularly sometimes the lower grades. At the upper grades, it was traumatic, even under the best circumstances. We thought that in order for black kids to get what white kids were getting, we had to put black kids where white kids were. Well, that was very naive, again, because of the hostility and all, that many schools, when they had to integrate, had been closed as black schools, whether they were good schools or bad schools, on the basis that whites would never send their children there. They would set up track systems, with a college-bound track and an intermediate track and a low track and non-college, and often enough the black kids would end up in that lower track, which going to a hostile environment and then being placed in sort of a dead-end situation, that was just asking for a lot of difficulties and trouble.
Yeah. One of the powerful metaphors in your book is black people trapped in a giant unseen gyroscope. Maybe you'd talk with us about that metaphor, which I think is something you've just touched on now. And is it possible to pry open that gyroscope?
I guess I would like to say I've gotten more optimistic as I got older, but I'm not sure I have. That the, I guess with the gyroscope, it just seems to me that, through mighty effort, black leaders and people and great sacrifice and all can get law kind of moved in their direction. But before long, like a gyroscope that you've tilted over, it returns to the even keel with whites in the dominant position and blacks in the subordinate position. And, it seems to me that we still have problems of housing discrimination and employment discrimination, and I'm not sure that the affirmative action, even at the college level, despite the Supreme Court's decision of last spring,
is not still a serious problem. But the I tell my students, many of whom are interested in civil rights and working in the area, that the main challenge, it seems to me, in the years to come is to somehow convince whites that while racism is comforting, that there are priorities and presumptions that go with being white in this country, that it comes at a high cost, that it causes whites not to recognize things that are in their interest. Whites rampaged after Lincoln issued the Emancipation Proclamation in New York. They lynched blacks that just were walking down the street and what have you. Though when Lincoln acted, it was in the country's interest, you see. Affirmative action has helped far more whites than it has blacks, particularly white women. And yet, you know, it is still seen as something that is an evil, and people would like to do away with it entirely. So that the and there are any number of other examples in our political situation. The politicians that were able to take advantage of the Brown decision, often enough, they didn't do anything else for the people except promise they were going to keep the schools segregated. And so they disadvantaged them in terms of a lot of other social care. You know, the social needs in southern states today are still at the very bottom. Certainly these are poorer states, but also there has not been the effort to do for the people, most of whom are white. And so that the great challenge, it seems to me, is to kind of get across that race, in fact, our nation's survival may depend on it. The stopper, though, Celeste, is that if tomorrow I had my wish in white racism disappeared, and whites recognized how they had been betrayed, really, because of their commitment to racism, how much they had missed out on, how much more people that looked like them but who were exploiting them. Gee, we would have major disruptions in this country, it seems to me. Mm. So that... But maybe that can happen on a more peaceful basis. But I just think that's the great challenge. Not that we shouldn't keep working to correct racial injustices, but it seems to me the major injustice is the failure of whites to understand that racism is expensive mm-hmm. for them.
Mm-hmm. I had an economics professor who said, if you hold anyone back, you hold everyone back.
Yeah. Well, I had an old guy in the audience and question and answer, and he said, Professor, old black guy said, Professor, you keep on trying with your civil rights stuff, but you got to remember that black folk can't get free till white folk get smart. Mm-hmm. That's a kind of a pessimistic viewpoint, but it's not without some truth.
Let's talk with another listener. Caller in Urbana, line one. Go ahead.
Professor, it's nice to engage you. Let's not forget that Karl Marx said that labor with a white skin can never emancipate itself, while labor with a black skin is branded. Mm. And let's go back to the question of Reconstruction here. Thaddeus Stevens and the Radical Republicans very nearly impeached Andrew Johnson for the failure to reconstruct the South.
Yeah.
And the slavers all got back into office.
Right.
Even William Tecumseh Sherman, who issued the 40 acres and a mule to every mm-hmm. free black man, that was overturned immediately. And Grant was, Sherman was a very reluctant fighter in the Indian Wars.
Yeah.
I think this is kind of crux, you know. Now, I grew up in Milwaukee, Wisconsin, which the Urban League at one point said was the most racist, segregated city in America. And I think it probably was, and probably still is. But the racism in the North and the racism in the South is much different. In the South, since everyone was poor, you know, black folk and white folk lived next door to each other, and there was no problem as long as black folk weren't driving better cars.
Yeah, or doing, because some of the major massacres, you can't call them riots, occurred in Florida and then in Oklahoma, in black communities that were perceived as doing well. You know, Greenwood in Oklahoma, where in 1923, I think, that they just came and wiped out the town. And in Rosewood, I guess in Florida, that they made the film about, was again a situation in which whites perceived that, how dare these blacks do well.
Right. Well, my question is, how does this relate to middle-class values, which I suppose if we could put the substance in the beaker on the Bunsen burner and reduce it to a residue, it would boil down to serve yourself and screw your buddy, would it not?
Well, unfortunately, there's an awful lot of that in our economic system. You know, the economic system is not supposed to work in a democratic country because the exploitation of those with economic power would be they would be overthrown by the people who recognize that they had to vote, and they would throw them out. But of course, it's worked quite well for 200 years here because of a number of factors. The sense that everybody's supposed to make it on their own, that there has been some redistribution of the wealth, and also racism has certainly played a part.
It certainly.
But, I mean, we don't really have a socialist party in this country.
Oh, and why don't we have a socialist party in this country? First of all, the German Social Democrats were racist, and even in Milwaukee, where the Social Democratic Party and the Socialist Party was a mayor, Frank Zeidler was mayor of Milwaukee as a socialist when McCarthy was the senator conducting the witch hunt. And it's livid, but it all reduces.
Same is true of the union movement. The union movement, with some exceptions, was very racist, even though it helped defeat their own ends. Because when they went out on strike, the employers, the corporate guys, would just hire blacks who otherwise wouldn't be hired. So that it is self-defeating in a number of ways. I mean, even our current political alignment, it seems to me that a great number of Americans vote for people that make them feel good, but who don't really give a damn about them in terms of things that they, education, health care, Social Security. We still have, 43 million people in this country with absolutely no health care, which is an abomination. And yet that... the one party is opposed to doing it, I think, and the other party seems to be afraid that if they put forth a major plan, that they'll lose some white votes or something like that. So that I don't want to repeat the Nader thing of 2000, that there wasn't a dime difference between the two parties, but we certainly don't have a true opposition party in this country. Both major parties are funded by some of the same corporate and well-heeled sources. The media is controlled by about four guys, major corporations. And so that it's really hard to get out any message that strays very much from the consensus.
Mm. On the political stage today, do you see people who are making a difference or who could make a difference?
Oh, sure. I think that they probably don't get the attention that some of the others. I still hail Barbara Lee, the black woman, the congresswoman out in Oakland, California, who voted against the first of these resolutions after 9/11. As far as I know, has voted against all of them. It turns out that she was had a prophetic view with regard to what was happening. But so many people are focused more on the next election and how they'll do and who will say something critical of them than they are on doing what's rather obvious, the right thing.
Hmm. There will We'll leave it. Derek Bell, thank you very much for talking with us this afternoon.
Oh, listen, I enjoyed it, Celeste. Take care out there in the Midwest. Hope you have a pleasant summer.
Okay. Thank you very much. Take care.
Bye-bye.
Bye. Derek Bell has been our guest. His latest book is Silent Covenants, Brown v. Board of Education and the Unfulfilled Hopes for Racial Reform. The book is published by Oxford University Press. 9 minutes before 2 o'clock, settlement prices should be in from the Chicago Board of Trade. Here's Todd Gleason.
Much less from the Chicago Board of Trade today. It was a quiet day, but a higher day in the corn pit and the bean pit for the trade. Volume was fairly light, according to the wire service reports. This is how things finished up in the wheat pit, where the trade was not following along with the corn and the beans, but running its own gamut, just slightly lower for the day. July futures in the wheat pit had a high of 382 and three quarters. They're low for the day at 374 and a settlement price at 378. They finished down a half cent for the day. September wheat now, 391, the high, the low at 382. Settled 384, they were down 2 cents for the day. And December contract, $4.50, the high, low at 392, settled 395 and a half, down one. March contract in the wheat pit, 406, the high, the low at 399 and a half, a settlement price at 401 and a half, down 2.5 cents. And the May futures at 404 on the high, the low, and the settlement price for the May wheat. They actually did not trade a day, so they finished unchanged on the day. July corn now 305, the high, the low at $3.50, and settlement price there at 303 and three quarters. They were up 7 3/4. September contract 299 and three quarters, the high, low at 296, settled 299 and one quarter, up 7.5 cents. The new crop on out, as well as the old crop, were buoyed today by ideas that the rainfall across much of the northern parts of Iowa, southern parts of Minnesota was so great that there could be a great deal of either lost acreage there or acreage that was impacted in terms of yield. That has yet to be seen, of course, as those soil conditions begin to dry out and farmers assess what happened over the weekend. There were parts, as we heard yesterday afternoon, that received between 8 and 11 inches over the last week or so in some of those areas, and that would be a lot of rainfall. December corn now 297, the high for the day, low at 293.5, a settlement price 296.5, up 7.25, and the March futures 301, the high, the low at 298.5, settlement price there $3.75. They finished up 7 cents on the day. May contract 304.5, high, low at 302, settled 304.5, up 7. And July corn 304, the high, the low at 301, settled 303.5, and they finished 7 higher as well. September futures 285, the high, the low at 281. September 2005 corn settled the day at 284 in Chicago, up 4 cents. And December contract 274.5, the high, the low at 272.5. The December 2005 corn, that's two crop years out, finished at 273, up 2 3/4 cents. July oats 153.5, the high, the low at 150.25. A settlement price there at 152 and three quarters, up 3. In September, 159.5, high, low at 156.25. Settled 157.5, and they were up 2.25 on the day. From the soy complex, beans managed a fairly decent little rally today, up 16 cents, 16.25, in fact. In the nearby Julys, they had a high of 896, a low at 873, and that July contract settled 882.25, up 16.25. August beans were up 18.25 with a high of 841.5, a low at 822, settlement price there at 830. They were up 18.25. September, 760.5, high, low at 747, settled 750.5, up 12.5. And your November's, your new crop, 718, the high, low at 706.5. The harvest month settled 710.25, up 11.75. January soybeans, 718.5, the high, the low at 708, settlement price there at 711, up 12 cents. And the March futures in the bean pit, 715.5, high, low at 707, settled 709. They finished 10.5 cents higher. May contract, 712, high, low at 703, settlement price at 703.5. And they finished up 12.5 cents. July bean meal, 290, the high, the low at 282, settlement price at 287, up 7.25. And the August, 275.70, high, low at 268.80, settlement price at 273, up 7 for the day. July futures for the bean oil, 29 even, the high, the low at 28.50, settled 28.74, up 45. And the August contract, 28.38, the high, the low at 28.95, a settlement there at 28.21, finished 49 higher. Now here's Celeste Quinn with the numbers from the Chicago Mercantile Exchange.
Thank you, Todd. Livestock prices finished lower today. May feeder cattle, the high 105.75, the low 105.25. The settlement 105.70, and this is the only contract that finished higher today on the mercantile exchange that we follow. It finished up, May feeder cattle finishing up 12.5 cents. August feeder cattle, 105.50, the high, the low, 102.67.5, the settlement 104.35, that down 132.5. September 104.20, the high, 101.40, the low, 103.25, the settlement, that down 115. June live cattle, 83.50 the high, 81.50 the low, 82.32.5 the settlement, that down 130. June, 86 even the high, 84.25 the low, the settlement, I just lost my place. Let's begin again with July live cattle. 86 even the high, 84.50 the low, and the settlement, 84.50, that down 250. August live cattle, 86.40 the high, 84.35 the settlement, 85.45 the settlement, that down 105. June lean hog, 75.40 the high, 74.80 the low, 74.92.5 the settlement, that down 82.5. July, 74.90 the high, 73.50 the low, 73.60 the settlement, that down 170. August lean hog, 73.45 the high, 72.30 the low, 72.50 the settlement, that down 135. October lean hog, 61.85 the high, 60.70 the low, 61.45 the settlement, that down 90. May bellies, 122 the high, the low, and the settlement, that's what the number reads across the screen, that down the limit today. Now let's take a look at what's happening on Wall Street. The Dow is currently up 100 points at 10,059. The S&P 500 up 12 points at 1107. And the NASDAQ is up 22 points at 1436.
This is Les Schulte, Director of Corporate Support. WILL has made a significant commitment to providing area farmers and agribusiness professionals with the best information possible. But we need your support to help continue and grow this service. If you own or manage a business, consider supporting WILL through one of our business programs. Call 217-333-0850 for more information.
Today's broadcast is made possible with support from the Illinois Farm Bureau, whose mission is to improve the economic well-being of agriculture and enrich the quality of farm family life.
It's time once again to Ask Dr. Science. So let's ask Dr. Science.
That's me.
Remember, he knows more than you do.
That's right.
Glenn Furr from Cary, North Carolina, wants to know, Dear Dr. Science, in the New Harvard Dictionary of Music, a statement is made that the clarinet plays or acts as a stopped pipe resonator. It actually sounds an octave lower than one would expect. It is similar in length to a flute or soprano sax, but sounds an octave lower. Can you explain why the clarinet sounds as a stopped pipe as opposed to the flute or sax, which sound as open pipes?
As anyone who's ever heard Prokofiev's Peter and the Wolf knows, the clarinet is actually a fossilized cat. Flutes are fossilized birds. Some birds are as big as cats, but they're still birds and therefore make a comparatively high-pitched or, scientifically speaking, tweety noise.